how we turn around our initial Einstein's equations for the full manifold in this picture where we are stacking a sequence of space-like hypersurfaces. And we can now see the problem rather than solving for the full metrics at the, of the space-time at just one given instant or at one go. Rather, we're now seeing it as a knowing what is the geometry at a given time, and provided we know or we're given some sources or some sources for the evolution or changes in the metric, we'll see that the metric changes according to these equations, where essentially the one that really has the degrees of freedom of the motion is this one that tells us how the extrinsic curvature, how this slice will change as we move along due to different sources. Some of the sources will be explicitly showing up, like this rho, the current J, and this S, which were different projections of our stress energy tensor. But also we might have true dynamics that does not have to do with any source, just coming from gravitational waves. For instance, they are propagated in our space. Gravitational waves have no associated stress energy tensor. And so there's going to be some intrinsic dynamics once we define the appropriate fields. So now what we want to do is just go back to a simpler case today, write down the equations of motion, and then begin to discuss general techniques that one would have to worry about to do these iterations. But we also then want to make a pause and for a full week discuss about something else, something where we don't have to worry that much about the how to reformulate the equations. We're going to prescribe them. We're going to go back to numerical techniques to worry now about what different types of sources we can consider might bring as far as difficulties in iterating them numerically. And we want also to put a break on this so that we can mull over and kind of this the information that we have been discussing can sink in before we can resume it in the last week. Otherwise, it might be too much. So for the moment now, we want to capture some of the basic things that, assuming we have a given source, we'll discuss how to iterate these equations numerically. And in the last part, I just want to say a few more things about numerical techniques because it ties with the discussions next week. But we don't want to start with the most complicated case. I already kind of went ahead of myself and told you that these equations are not nice equations to iterate numerically in three dimensions, but they're just perfectly fine in one dimension. And this is something, again, we'll discuss on the third week why this is so, and it actually has to do with what we discussed yesterday. If we write these equations in full 3D and we analyze the characteristics, the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of the resulting system, we'll find that there are some eigenvalues that are degenerate. We're going to have repeated eigenvalues where we cannot find a complete set of eigenvectors. It is that that turns out to be the problem, and we'll find a way to fix it, which is not going to be too difficult, but it required quite a bit of pain in the community to understand its full implications. But so now we want to kind of also take a step back and think of, given these equations, let's look at a case where we know it works. So we're going to just go to spherical symmetry so that a lot of things will be simplified. We'll also be thinking about sources, but as I told you, some of these sources will have equations of motion. So because, again, here this is not a complete problem. I still have to tell you what the density of energy is, what the current is, and what this component of this purely special component of the stress energy tensor is. And that comes from outside. That has to come from the particular system you're dealing with. If you're dealing with vacuum, all those quantities are zero. If you're dealing with interaction with some stress energy tensor that provides some extra energy component or energy contribution to the space-time, then you have to think about what is the model you're dealing with. So if you're thinking about the interaction between, I don't know, some scalar field or some electromagnetic field or some matter, this is what has to be added. And we also have to add here the equations of motions that determine how these quantities vary. So we're going to now look at, A, we're going to simplify this system of equations by looking at just spherical symmetry, and B, we're going to look at one very specific type of matter or energy field that also is sufficiently simple that everything we've been saying so far is applicable. The techniques we'll discuss next week are for fields that obey a much more complicated set of equations. We're going to think of things as in Venus. We're going to set up the simplest possible way. So immediately we have to also consider something that has to do with this. If we're going to be thinking about general relativity in four dimensions that is purely spherically symmetric, we immediately know by Birkhoff's theorem that there is really no dynamics there. There is no radiation, because if it is spherically symmetric, everything we're considering has to, at most, to just a breathing mode. But as far as the gravitational field, there is no propagation of degrees of freedom because there are no gravitational waves. So that also ties into why we're going to attach to it some matter source, or some energy source, rather, that will produce the dynamics, the non-trivial dynamics for us. And so the simplest possible system that we can think of is that of a scalar field. And that's usually the system is known as Einstein-Klein-Gordon field, or Einstein-Klein-Gordon massless scalar field that is minimally coupled. We'll discuss the Lagrangian in just a second. And the good thing is that the scalar field, while gravity cannot have radiation, the scalar field can. We're going to be able to lose energy from the system in the form of scalar waves. So the Lagrangian of the system is defined this way. So there is a contribution, the standard contribution due to the Einstein term, just the Ricci scalar. We're going to attach to it this one. It is minimally coupled because the way the behavior of the field is coupled to the behavior of the geometry is just through this covariant derivatives that are in there. So with that, you can derive what the equations of motions are. Einstein's equations would say GAB equal A pi TAB, where a stress energy tensor is related to the scalar field in this way. So it's just in that form. And if you deduce from the Lagrangian what is the equations of motion, or what are the equations of motion that determine the scalar field behavior, it's just given by the box of the scalar field equal to zero. So now we have two pieces, or one piece of very useful good news in here. Remember, yesterday I argued that we had to analyze the characteristics of the problem to know if things are well behaved. The good thing in this case, and this actually will be quite generic, is that, remember, Einstein's equations are sitting here, or the part of the derivative of the metric are sitting here, which has second derivative at the highest derivatives. The right-hand side, the contribution of the scalar field, contains only first-order derivatives, while the equation of motion of the scalar field is given by second-order derivatives. So if we look at the principal part of the equation that has the highest derivatives, this can be ignored as far as analyzing the characteristics. So the only thing I'm going after with that is that to say, if you understood the characteristics of your problem in the vacuum case, the same will hold true for a case where there is a source of energy given by the scalar field, but because the scalar field enters with lower order terms, nothing changes. If we do the analysis, we'll have to ignore all that. Of course, in practice, when we do the full numerical solution, we have to account for it, but the characteristics will be exactly the same ones. Spherical symmetry will let us also simplify things a lot. So if we now take an arbitrary hypersurface at a given constant, at a given time, one of these slices sigma that we define, and we impose that we have spherical symmetry, well, we know immediately that the most general metric that describes a three-dimensional manifold that is spherically symmetric is diagonal, if we choose the right coordinates, of course, is diagonal, and we have a function which can we're going to define it as a square, multiplying the dr square part of the line element. Then we have something that multiplies, so this d theta square, and the same thing with a sine square theta multiplying the d phi square. This function rb, which notice that we could have absorbed the r into the b and just define the whole thing as b square, because after all, we're saying that B is a function of R and time. We're splitting it this way so that if A happens to be 1 and B happens to be 1, we're back to just flat space then. So it's just a convenient kind of conformal way of writing what B will be. And B then measures how the fact that we now have curvature will change the area of surfaces at constant radius. So we also mentioned that in order to fully specify the problem, even if we were dealing with just vacuum, we still have to specify alpha and beta. So just to be consistent with spherical symmetry, we're going to define, and we're using spherical coordinates, we're going to define this beta to only have component in, along the radial direction. We don't want anything along the theta and phi direction because that will be distorting our coordinates, and we will lose the explicit spherical symmetry of the problem. And just having defined the metric this way, well, the down index, the downstairs version of the shift vector has an a squared. So the dual to the shift vector is a squared times beta. And because we have only one piece of information that we have to give beta I, we're just going to call now beta the radial component of the shift. So now the most general four metric for our spacetime is just this, where we have used what we have been discussing. The time-time component has a minus alpha squared, a squared beta squared. Then we have this term, and then we have the special part of the metric. We can now go with this definition, and what we know as far as the definition of the extrinsic curvature is, we can compute immediately what the extrinsic curvature is, at least formally. We still don't know what is the explicit expression for a given situation, but the general expression can be computed using the fact that the metric is purely purely diagonal, the space part of it. We can tell immediately that the extrinsic curvature, with one index up and one index down, is also a diagonal, and it has these components, where these two are exactly the same. If we were to compute both index down, well, we're going to have a sine squared theta showing up there, but that's all there is to it. And the reason I'm pointing this out is that you notice that as far as the three metric was concerned, we only have two pieces of information eventually solve, A and B. Analogously for K, we only have two pieces of information to eventually give to fully define the spacetime, K, or how this surface is embedded in the higher dimensional spacetime, KRR and K theta theta. So if we want to now compare how much we simplified thanks to spherical symmetry, well, if we were in three dimensions, we had to give six components for the intrinsic metric to the hypersurface, six components to the extrinsic metric to the hypersurface, that's 12. 12 plus alpha and beta, which is a vector, that's 16. Yes?
So here when you say that we can calculate the extrinsic curvature, you mean the extrinsic curvature of
the hypersurface? Yes. Exactly. And we calculate just by definition. We know that K is related to the time derivative of G. We don't know what G is. We don't know what is time derivative. But formally, we just see, given that we have a bunch of zeros here, and that will be still maintained, given that we're in spherical symmetry, well, the same thing would be here. We don't have kr theta, kr phi, etc. So just counting here, we had 12 in here plus alpha and beta. We have 16 pieces of information in three dimensions to give. After we assume spherical symmetry, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So we went from 16 to 6. So now let's push a little bit and now try to re-express these equations for the particular situation we're dealing with. Okay, so that's the first equation, the Hamiltonian constraint. That's the momentum constraint. We now, rather than in this case where we were talking at the formal level, we have an explicit stress energy tensor, so we can define what rho is and what j is, And we are going to use the fact that we know that the n is minus alpha to then simplify the equations. Same thing for this equation. And that equation turns into this. Gamma dot is equal to, well, that term. Notice this is the term that says gamma dot is related to the extrinsic curvature, but remember there was also the piece of the lead derivative along the shift director, the shift vector, if we had one. These are coming, these are the three pieces that come due to that. And for the k dot equation, we have a similar contribution. This contribution, these three contributions, come from the lead derivative, and the rest is given by all these things. And so now let's just use our simpler looking metric and compute all the different pieces that will come in here. So we need to compute the Ricci. We need to compute second derivatives, covariant derivatives of the Laplace, and so on. So that for that, it's going to be handy to have the Christoffel symbols associated to the metric, the gamma metric. So here is just a list of all of them. I mean, it's just a simple calculation. You can also compute the components of the Ricci tensor, and pretty much everything vanishes but two components, these two. Where now we have explicitly showing the different components that we have assigned. Notice that because it's the Ricci of the three metric, or the metric of the spatial Hilbert surface, there shouldn't be any alpha or beta here, because that just has to do with the coordinates and how this hypersurface embeds in the higher dimensional spacetime. As far as the Ricci of the three hypersurfaces is concerned, that's the only thing that needs to matter for it, is the metric intrinsic to the hypersurface. So when you put everything together, well, there are a few combinations that we have to evaluate, the components of the Ricci, but also the Ricci scalar. That shows up here in the Hamiltonian constraint. And then you can compute the second derivative of the Laplace. So let me just... those are just straightforward computations. Now we need to add a little bit on the explicit calculation of the contributions brought in by the scalar field. Here it's similar to what we said, discussed briefly yesterday. We're trying to write things in a simpler form. We're going to reduce, as far as the scalar field is concerned, as first order time derivative equations, as we did here. Notice that the highest derivatives we have are first order time derivatives. So to do that, we start with the wave equation for the scalar field, and we introduce two variables, just as in our toy problem. So we have one field that will encode the spatial derivative of the field, and we have another that will encode the time derivative, but we're actually adding a little bit more. Notice this thing, forget about the A, this thing has the time derivative of the scalar field, phi, minus beta times the spatial derivative of the scalar field phi, divided by alpha. This is precisely, this combination, is precisely the time derivative along a normal observer. So this pi, we're choosing it to be the time given by the time, or the derivative along the normal observer, times this A. This is totally free. I mean, you could have chosen just to say pi equal phi dot. This is just a something we can, there is total freedom here. Yeah. Canonical momentum with respect to that observer, the normal observer. Okay, so this is just the metric and the inverse. To deduce now the different contributions, we now remember the rho was the normal projection of the stress energy tensor. And so you can just check through the simple algebra and replace every time you have a special derivative by phi. And every time you have a time derivative, by the appropriate combination that will give you phi. So for instance, rho, this is kind of rather intuitive. If rho is the energy density measured by normal observers, it better be what we would assign for the energy. And so here we have pi squared plus phi squared. this is the time derivative plus potential plus the gradient of the scalar field, and this field, this a squared comes in there because of the definition of pi, because we've taken that ia, that we would have changed this to the point of even not having shown up. So that's part of the ambiguity in introducing new variables. As long as we do everything consistently, everything is fine. So again, so these are other components that would enter in here. We're just after writing the final equations. Well, too much. Okay, so now this would be what the Hamiltonian constraint looks like. Same thing with the, for the momentum constraint. It gives us, sorry, this equation. And for the evolution equations, we just have actually two. These are the simple relationships that define k, r, r, and k theta theta, that then we turn it around and reinterpret them as evolutions of the time of evolution equations for a and b. We now need to give the evolution equations for this case. And that's what we get for them. So these are the equations that we need to solve. Which are not too distinct from, we're not too different from just wave equations. That's one of the reasons we kept going or talking about the wave equations. Einstein's equations can be rendered in ways that look very much like complicated wave equations. And part of the analysis or the redefinitions of the equations for the general purpose will try to make use the advantage of knowing that these equations have to be satisfied at every single slice. We're going to play with this, add them to the evolution equations in a particular way so as to get rid of some possibly offending terms that are part of the problems that these equations have, but not in spherical symmetry. Oops. I lost my equations. So these nodes, as I said, they're sufficiently clean that you may find it useful to just follow them up. Just try to rederive every step. It will be a useful exercise. Okay, so the last thing we need to discuss is, so we wrote Einstein's equations in a spherically symmetric case. We need to do the same thing for the source that will be varying with time. It's defined through a wave equation. And so we had introduced these definitions for pi, and phi was the derivative with respect to the radial coordinate of the field phi. And so then we can just as we did with, say, Einstein's equations, we can reinterpret this as the phi dot equation, right? So then the phi dot can be written this one gives me the phi dot equation, like so, to obtain the phi, this capital phi dot. We do exactly the same thing we did before for the other example. So we had an equation that says, from the first equation, we have phi dot equal alpha divided by a pi plus beta. But I know I need an equation for phi dot, so I can take, I can remember that phi was phi comma r, and I'm taking the dot. So if I commute derivatives, the equation for capital phi dot will come from here if I take the real derivative. So that's what this line is saying. We just get it from there. And the evolution equation for pi, well, it has to come from the true principal part of this equation that will have pi is in there, so we just have to express out what the box of phi is, and then just identify the appropriate terms. In there will be a time first time derivative of pi, or first time derivative of pi and the second time derivative of pi, which we then have to write in terms of pi. And after it's not too complicated in algebra, then you end up with this equation. So it's pi dot equal to this kind of thing. Where if we take the limit of being extremely far as far as from kind of a centralized source, and assuming that, say, beta goes to 0 if we go far, alpha goes to 1 if we go far, what we'll have is everything essentially drops out, except as far as the principal part is concerned, and the leading derivatives will have a pi dot equal here a phi comma r. And that's, remember, we were dealing with an equation, with the wave equation, we had pi dot equal pi comma r, or pi comma x, and pi dot is equal p comma x, and p dot equal pi comma r, it's in here. Same equation. Okay, so this is, suppose now, this is what you would do. Every time you do a numerical calculation, you say, this is my problem, you derive the equations you're going to solve, and you say, okay, now I think I'm ready to go onto the numerical arena and begin to write a code for it. Well, there is a little bit of extra things that we already know we have to deal with. The first thing is to understand what are the characteristics of the problem for the reasons we say, for checking if the equations we're going to deal with are well-behaved. That's order 0. Order 1, understanding how we're going to deal with boundary conditions. And order 2, knowing how fast things will propagate will also let us understand how we have to work at the numerical level to make sure that things will be stable. So this is just things that essentially we have already discussed. We can analyze the stability of the problem. And the good thing, this is what I briefly mentioned at the beginning, is the fact that these equations, we have Einstein's equations coupled to the fields, but the fields only come with lower order derivatives, therefore it doesn't matter. So if you analyze the Einstein's equations and find, then you know in the vacuum, you know they're fine here. The other thing we need to make sure is that the equations determine the scalar field behavior are also fine. And gravity only enters through lower derivatives, so we also can ignore gravity. In a sense, it's just going to show up as some basic terms that are undifferentiated, so we can imagine that gravity stays put at any given time, and we analyze that. So we, again, can do this analysis of how phi and pi behave, and this is precisely what we discussed yesterday. We write the matrix that will define the problem. I think yesterday I defined A. Yeah, so I had defined A with a minus sign, but it was sitting on the other side. So with the plus sign, but it was sitting on the other side, so it's exactly the same problem. So if you analyze the characteristics, you find that the characteristics of this problem are given by minus beta plus minus alpha divided by A, which is what we discussed yesterday. Again, if we go very far out, the beta, with a usefully defined beta, the beta will go to 0, alpha and A will go to 1, so we'll have the characteristics being plus and minus 1, the eigenvalues being plus and minus 1. But as we move inwards, beta might get larger and larger to the point of overwhelming the positive side, and then have the characteristics tilt over in one direction or the other one, which will come in handy. So this at least tells us that if, going back to the discussions of yesterday, first thing is we obtain characteristics that are real. That's a good sign, remember? That kind of is the most important condition in a sense, because if it is imaginary, we know something went wrong. We also know it's going to be bounded if beta, alpha, and A are bounded. So we're going to have an upper bound of how fast things can propagate. So we can make sense of how fast will something wrong at the outer boundary might propagate and affect things at a given point. We can always estimate that using this. As we'll discuss later, knowing that also there is an upper bound to the possible characteristic speeds, also is something we want to know to understand how distant can this hypersurface be at most for a stable implementation? And we're going to use this again for boundary conditions. But notice that we have yet to say anything about how we're going to choose beta and alpha. Every now and then I have been dropping conditions like we want beta to go to 0, we want alpha to go to 1, but we haven't said anything about how we're going to choose them. Okay, so let me just say a few more things. So let's suppose we now want to solve this problem. We want to send some scalar field energy, so something that happens to be coming into this, say, into this room at some given time, and then two things can happen. We could be sending so much energy that all of a sudden a black hole forms here and we're all dead, but at least in the meantime we want to know what's going on. Or we didn't send enough energy, the energy will come in, go through each other, and essentially will escape, and nothing major happened. In between, maybe we felt a stronger gravitational pull due to this extra energy that was around us, but then it goes away and nothing happens. So now we have to wonder how we're going to think of distributing points in our space, and how far do we want to go? Well, presumably, if we want to know about everything that is of relevance, especially what is the metric, what is the gravitational potential around us, we want to go all the way to where we are. So we would like to have as an inner boundary where we are, I'm going to set that to be r equals 0. We're going to choose the origin to be with us. Also, presumably, we don't care, or we shouldn't have to worry too much about what's going on in a galaxy far away from here. So we don't want to go all the way to infinity. We say we're going to be happy to specify in some outer boundary. And then we might have to work hard to convince anyone that having placed this boundary at a finite location does not affect the physics that we're seeing. But that's an easy thing to convey. We could run our simulations twice, one with the boundary here, the other with the boundary there, and show that the results are essentially the same for a long time. So you're saying, okay, if the boundary is influencing, it's not having a huge influence. Also, by knowing the characteristics, suppose the characteristics is this fast, we know that in here, the boundary could never have any influence, but it definitely has an influence here. And so but we can monitor some observables, some physical quantities, and we can ask the question, if we go in this direction and we cross this kind of threshold where we know the boundary should be influencing things, and we don't see any dramatic change, we see things being very smoothly behaved, then we can have some confidence that even though we're not perhaps doing the best possible job here in our boundary conditions, the boundary conditions we have chosen are not fundamentally affecting the physics we're measuring here. So it's always possible to convince anyone that the boundaries are not playing a major role. The problem we have is this one. So this is a completely artificial boundary. So at r equals 0, there is nothing. If I think of the origin here, that's an arbitrarily chosen point. If I had energy that was coming this way, it would just keep going in that way, except that we just choose to put that origin because we're using these spherical coordinates. So that's one problem that spherical coordinates have, that have this singularity, coordinate singularity, which is totally artificial sitting at the origin. So in practice, because we're going to be iterating between r equal to 0 to r some outer boundary, we're going to have to put a boundary condition there just by hand, simply because we're choosing this coordinate to evolve things. If we were using Cartesian coordinates that have no origin, no particular origins, we could just be using something like this, as opposed to be using something like this. Right, so here we see that all lines are meeting at a single point. That's a reason why we have a coordinate singularity at r equals 0 when we use spherical coordinates. Well, that problem is not here. There is nothing special if we compare this box with that box, with this box, or anyone here. This is completely artificial due to the choice of coordinates that we have. But of course, we want to use these coordinates because these are the coordinates that make our symmetries explicit, where we can take advantage of everything that we know that the spherical symmetry allows us to do. So there is this tension. This would be the easiest one, but we have to deal with higher dimensions or a higher dimensional problem in principle. This one is a little bit more complicated, but lets us take advantage of a bunch of things. There are techniques that kind of merge these two. We're not going to discuss this. Maybe if you're interested, we can have a little chat on these things the last day. But let's keep this one, which is the closest one to the closest approach that you have taken if you are doing this problem in pencil and paper. If you were doing these things with pencil and paper, you would never think of going this way. You would always do this. So now we have to live with the fact that we want to do something at r equals 0, and things may be delicate there. So because we can argue in two ways, let me just do it pictorially. Because this point, say this point is lives there. Because this point is not special at all, our boundary condition should reflect that. And what we're going to ask is that whatever happens there, it should leave the space regular. Because again, the coordinates, the singularity there is just a coordinate singularity. So that's, we're going to discuss a little bit about what boundary conditions we would put to ensure that nothing strange will happen there. We can do this in a formal way, of course, by demanding that the principle of equivalence tells us that if I take a sufficiently small neighborhood of a point, things should look very much like flat space time there, unless there is a naked singularity, and we know this is not the case. So we're going to use the fact that if we concentrate on a small enough neighborhood of the origin, things should just look like flat. And so we expect things to behave in a very particular manner. In particular, we shouldn't see any kink in the fields. If a field is going to that point, it should be regular. And so the regularity will enforce. So this is what I'm saying in words, will enforce that all relevant fields will behave as some constant which we don't know, or some function of time which we don't know. This is what we're trying to solve. But the next term should go like R squared. We shouldn't have an R there because that will have a kink in that point, at the origin. So we're going to ask that all objects behave that. And if they behave this behavior, and I take a spatial derivative of this one, we knock off that term. This becomes R times a time function, a function that depends on time. And if I evaluate exactly at R equals 0, all derivatives will go to 0. Is that clear? And so as a result, that's the boundary, quote-unquote, boundary condition that we could specify at the origin for our conditions. So then the next thing, this is the last thing I want to discuss. So that takes care of inner boundary conditions. Outer boundary conditions, we do exactly what we did yesterday. We analyze the characteristics. We see which modes are incoming. Those are the modes we can define something for, and we'll usually choose the simplest one. Nothing is incoming, so we set all the incoming modes to 0. But the situation may change a lot. Here, suppose we discuss that if we put enough energy that concentrates in a small enough region at a given time, we might end up forming a black hole. If we form a black hole, this assumption will no longer hold that we have a regular R equals 0. There we know it's going to be totally irregular because we're going to find an naked singularity. So we need a way to specify or to realize where there is a black hole that comes in. But there is a problem with black holes, as you know well. That a black hole notion is a global notion. You only know if you have a black hole only when you have obtained the full spacetime. But here, you're building up the spacetime as you go. So there's a tension there again. How do you know there is an event a black hole if you haven't finished the spacetime to begin with? Luckily, there is this concept, the concept of trapped surfaces, or more, depending on how you call it, sometimes more loosely called apparent horizon. Apparent horizon is a special case of this one. Have you guys heard of apparent horizons or trapped surfaces before? Okay, so this is the closest we can get at any given time to saying there is a horizon. And let me just give you the intuitive definition first, and you'll see this very, in a way, it's very obvious. Suppose you build up a surface. You are free to choose any surface you want. On that surface, you send laser point, you put a bunch of laser pointers and you turn them off. If there is nothing, if the space-time around it is sufficiently not curved, these lasers will just form a divergent beam, right? So if you have that, this one will go like that, this one will go like that. And if I measure what is the area of at some given distance, the area formed by the divergent beam is getting larger and larger. That means these rays are not trapped. They are going all the way to infinity. Now think if you are using what you know about black holes, think what happened in the opposite. Suppose you're doing exactly the same exercise inside a black hole. Forget that you are not going to live that long, but it doesn't matter. Suppose we're inside a huge black hole. You turn those lasers, and the laser beams will not be going outwards. Sometimes they just get trapped. And they cannot keep expanding forever just because you know we're inside a black hole. So the trapped surface is just the formalization of this intuitive notion. Imagine that you have a surface, you send rays out, and then you ask the question, are those rays trapped? Are those rays forming a divergent beam or a convergent beam? And what is called the apparent horizon is the largest of these trapped surfaces you can find, whose rays are not totally trapped, are not convergent, but are exactly have neither divergence nor convergence. They are just at the border. So that's the largest possible surface. So if you were in, now think about doing that exercise in Schwarzschild, and we use these coordinates that we introduced yesterday, the Ingold and the Eddington-Finkelstein that are regular. Let me just define that. If these are equal to m, and let's say we keep things in spherical symmetry, if you choose all the surface will have beams that go, that are convergent, except when you are there. Right when you're there, they have zero divergence. They're neither divergent nor convergent. And if you go a little bit outside, all of a sudden they diverge again. If you're in stationary spacetimes, you can prove that if you find a trapped surface, the trapped surface will be part of the horizon, the black hole horizon, once you finish the spacetime. If you're in a general dynamical scenario, you can also prove that if cosmic censorship holds, of course, if there is eventually going to be an event horizon, the trapped surfaces will always be inside the event horizon. So the existence of an event horizon, of a trapped surface, immediately tells us there is going to be eventually an event horizon that is either at the trapped surface or some distance away from it. In spherical symmetry, finding an event horizon a trapped surface is very simple because we have a spherical symmetry, we just have spherical spheres. But if you are in three dimensions, the horizon can be, the trapped surface can be very, very distorted. Again, remember the apparent horizon is the outermost trapped surface. So if you insist on looking at spherical hypersurfaces, let me just give you, and we know this is the case, so if we have two black holes that are colliding next to each other, so they're against each other, there is a moment where the horizon has, say, these two distinct kind of spherical sections, they come together, they form a single one, and eventually you get to the stationary regime. So there is a scenario that if they are sufficiently close, you might have an instant of time where the horizon looks like this. Right? So now if you insist on finding trapped surfaces that are topologically, that are spherical with respect to your coordinates, then the largest you'd find is this one. Right? That's the largest surface that you can find that will be totally trapped. But that's because you insisted on using a spherical surface. If you now allow for topological spherical surface but very distorted, you might find that this surface is also trapped. Right? So that's why finding the apparent horizon sometimes is very tough, because if the situation is very distorted, you're going to have to allow for your surface to be very distorted, and that involves much more work. In many situations, however, the only thing you care about is just finding out where there's going to be a horizon so that you don't try to, or so that you react appropriately. Perhaps you don't try to iterate all the way to r equals 0, or you use the laps to your advantage to, given that you know that there is going to be a singularity soon after that you don't want to get to, you're going to slow down time so that the slices begin to get deformed. But these are things that we'll discuss in the third week. So let me just complete this and say the last thing I want to say on the R. So this is what we just said, essentially, sorry. So how do you find the surface? Again, we want to, given a surface, we want to define null rays that would be our laser pointer that is normal to the surface and is trying to send a ray outwards. Why do we choose it normal to the surface? Because, well, the more tangential, if it's going to be trapped, we want to have the worst case scenario, the one where we're really trying to get out. So we want the normal to the surface. And in particular, we want the outgoing normal. So we draw a surface. We look for that ray all around the surface, and we want that to form a non-divergent beam. And this is what I want to say. So you want the outgoing, the normal, because if this may be trapped, one that goes to at an angle, but the one that is going directly normal might not be. So you're looking for the worst possible case. You want all null rays to be trapped. So the easiest way to define, yes? So it's going to depend. No, that's an extremely important question. It depends on the lapse. So the lapse and the shift, but in particular the lapse, is what it's telling us, okay, keep going in time. So if your lapse is such that you're going fast in time, it could be that at this hypersurface you form your horizon, and the next one you hit the singularity and you're done. So you might not have enough time to find it, and then you're done. But we're going to describe some ways of choosing the lapse so that it's going to be tied to the curvature, the local curvature you're measuring. And if it realizes that something bad is going to happen, you can do two things. One is to say, I'm either going to slow down time so that you don't get into that problem, which brings some other problems, depending on what you're trying to do, or you're going to excise the singularity. You're going to say, okay, if this is my trap surface, and I know the trap surface is inside of an horizon, I'm just going to stop evolving. I'm going to put another boundary here. But yes, it affects your numerics in that point of view, in that way, that you have to react in some way. Of course, you don't want to react discontinuously, so you want to do it in a gradual way, unless, of course, what you're going to do is just say, okay, I chop it. I no longer evolve this inner region, but I know for sure that all my characteristics are going in. So if I have this example again, if I know this is my horizon, say, for Schwarzschild, we knew that here, so this is where our null cone had one characteristic going out, one in. Here the null cone tips over, and anywhere in between is completely tilted over. So at any given, if you have your boundary here, say, r equal 1, at any given time you can say, okay, I'm not going to go all the way to 1, I'm going to go to 1.5. And because everything is going in that direction, you're not doing anything. So it's like saying you see a river flow, and I'm looking at the river flow here, and there I have a dam. So where they have the dam there or here, it doesn't change anything here because the flow is just going in that direction. So let me just formalize this. So this is what we want to do. Just the only thing we're going to do is just formalize this argument. We want to define the outgoing normal with respect to some arbitrarily chosen surface. And then we're going to say, let's see if that surface is trapped or not. So we want the outgoing normal, and I'm going to define it UA, so that we can distinguish between the N and all the other surfaces, the normals that we've defined. So I'm going to define this one to be UA. But I'm going to remember that everything that I'm trying to do is write things with respect to the space-like hypersurface and how it's embedded in the higher dimensional space. So for simplicity, I'm going to write this UA as a combination of two vectors. One is a purely time-like, so this one is a purely normal to my highest hypersurface, and the other one is a trivial one, which is the outward normal pointing orthogonal to the space-like hypersurface. Sorry, the surface that we're defining on the hypersurface. So this is the construction. I have a hypersurface here. As I'm given time, this is sigma t. I'm going to choose a surface here. right? So that's the one I want to ask the question, is it orthogonal, is it trapped or not? Or the rays, the null rays emanating from it are trapped or not. I want to find this one that goes out as, at the speed of light. So it's a null ray that is going out, and it's because it's going out, it's going at the speed of light, it cannot just leave on the hypersurface, right? Because the hypersurface is purely space-like. So it has to have a component of the hypersurface, and I'm going to choose to write this as a two vectors. One that points up, and another one that point that leaves on the hypersurface and it points directly orthogonal to the hypersurface. This is what I'm going to call S. And I'm going to normalize this one. I'm going to normalize that one, right? So the full norm of UA is going to be zero. We want a null ray, right? But because this one has norm one, sorry, minus one, and this one has norm one, then total norm of U is going to be zero. So that's a trivial way of getting the null ray that we wanted. This is our laser pointer. So then what goes next is just saying, let's rewrite that. This is going to be the condition that says our null ray, our laser pointer, is that is defined orthogonal to the hyper to that surface at a given hypersurface that we have defined is trapped. The divergence is zero. So the only thing that I'm doing now is to say, let's write that. Let's again bite the bullet and do the work that we did yesterday, or we went through briefly yesterday, and that is in the notes. Let's rewrite this in terms of quantities that are intrinsic to the hypersurface and extrinsic to the hypersurface. And so it's not too difficult. In fact, you might, if you want to begin trying to do calculations to do this splitting, this is perhaps the simplest one you can start with. So you introduce the projectors, as we did yesterday. And just as we did yesterday, we can introduce several projectors. So let me just write here. Remember, we introduced one projector, which was this projected from four dimensions to sigma, to three dimensions. Now, and we define the metric, this was gamma AB. Right? We can also define a projector that goes from sigma to the surface S. Let me call this S. And exactly in the same way, except that there is going to be one sign chain. And that projector, which is called here H, is gamma AB minus SA SB. So there are two things. This, there is a minus here, because now we're living on the hypersurface. So I claim it's a projector. That means that if you take any vector, it will project it along this hypersurface, this surface. So if I take any vector along S and I multiply by this H, I should get a zero. And that's trivially obtained. If I multiply this by SB, this one gives me SA. This one, remember, S is a space-like, it's a space-like vector with norm 1. SB, SB gives me 1, and it's have minus SA, so getting a zero. So that will come in handy in doing the calculations. So let me just give you the punchline. But so give this a try. We can go over it afterwards if you have any problem. You can show at the end of the day that the condition of trap is equivalent or can be written in terms of things that are purely living on the hypersurface in this way. So it has to do with the derivative or the divergence of S as measured in the hypersurface. So I want to know if this S along the hypersurface is divergent, convergent, or not. But I need to have a little bit of extra contributions, and this is that come with the K, that tells us how this hypersurface is bent or not. So in practice, that's what we that's what you do. The good thing is just an evaluation. This does not feed into evolution in any way. It's just something that you have there, and you are computing along the fly. And at some point, you might say, yes, I have a surface that is trapped, and then you have to decide what to do. And so for this particular case, after you do the computation, the condition ends up being this way. So at every single time, this is just an evaluation. So you can just go, imagine that your surfaces leave are surfaces that are at different values of r. So at every value of r, you can evaluate this equation. Far out, you're going to see that this is definitely not zero, because everything is not trapped far out. And so it's going to be positive at very large distances. It goes at some point, crosses zero, and then it changes sign. And in this case, remember the characteristics were given by this object. And when the cone tilts over, this combination is precisely zero. So this is what it says. At some point, this is zero. And what it's telling us that coordinates just leave on these coordinates just leave tangential to the event horizon. But anyway, so this is something we'll see in the applications themselves. So again, these are our notes. So we're going to say, as I said, we're going to stop. I need 10 more minutes to tell you something else, but we're going to stop now chugging along with 3 plus 1. We're going to change gears next week so that there is time for this to sink in. Go over the notes. If you have any questions, ask me, Dennis, or Scott, because this is something that is good. It's useful regardless of whether you ever care to do numerics or not. As I said, some of these calculations are naturally showing up when you do ADS-CFT correspondence and you're trying to induce things on a given hypersurface and just evaluate things there. It comes in the analysis of membranes or brains in fluids. So this is useful beyond our current goals. Let me just show you one more thing I wanted to say. Now what do I do? Let me just change this. Okay, so something that we have briefly touched every now and then, but never actually had put real criteria or discussed in any detail, is stability. At the end of the day, it is much more, it's quite common, and you have already seen some examples when you play with your code and you change your boundary condition, and you saw a nice pulse going to the boundary on the side, and this hugely high frequency thing going back, and maybe the amplitude just going to hell. That usually is a blow up in the code. You want to know for sure what the cause of that. It could be the equations. We already said that if you happen to have an eigenvalue that is imaginary, that absolutely would be the case. But if you did your work at the analytical level and you're absolutely certain that your equations are fine, you're absolutely certain that your implementation, that you haven't made any mistake in coding up the problem, because you could have made up and just change a sign there and all the sign things just go in the opposite way. And you could be, you have done everything you could at the analytical level to turn the equations in the best possible way. You put in the code and the code blows up. So you need to understand what's going on. You need to understand whether it is the case that the blowing up behavior is due to something that you're not doing correct, or it's just because the numerical solution admits that blowing up solution, and you want to know how to get rid of it. So this is where perhaps a lot of, huge amount of pain goes in. So as I said, this is essentially the basics. We're going to go back to, our workhorse example, which is the wave equation. We want to say, okay, what are the criteria or what are the basic conditions we need to at least satisfy to make sure we're not screwing things up? So everything boils down, and this we already wrote one day, to say, well, we want to know that the norm of the solution at any given time is related to the norm of the solution at the initial time. Why do we care about that? Well, we care about that for many reasons. One of them is to make sure. Let's say this. Suppose we're able to establish that somehow the solution at time t, the norm of the solution at time t, is related, and this wiggle thing can hide a lot of things, but it's related to the norm of the solution at the initial time, which is the initial data. So that tells us, allows us to do a lot of things. In particular, allows us to say there is a unique solution. How do we know that? Well, we know that suppose you have two, so now you give initial data. Let me just say initial data U1 at t equals 0, and initial data U2 at t equals 0. Well, the difference of the two can also be initial data that we give. And so then we would say that the solution at time t minus the difference, well, let me just do it this way. And the norm of the solution, the difference of the solutions, will be related to the norm of the difference in the initial data. That means if I make U2 arbitrarily close to U1, I should get a 0, which says the solution U2 is arbitrarily close to U1. So that allows us to say we have a unique solution, and many of the theorems that prove you can have a unique solution relies on showing this. It also tells you that you can do the numerics, because you will say that if you don't quite have initial data U1, but you're putting initial data U2, which is as close as you can to U1, the solution U2 that you obtain is close in a given mathematical sense to U1 that is bounded. So in principle, if you don't quite get the solution you were looking for, then you translate into saying, okay, I just need to do better work in specifying the initial condition. So that's a property we care. So let me just also remind you of one particular method that we define to evolving, say, in this scheme where we use this three-level scheme, but this is generic, right, to obtain the solution there. We wrote that the solution could be written this way. And in general, in all explicit schemes, you end up writing, at least kind of pictorially, a scheme that says, I'm going to get the solution at the new level, using the solution at the previous level, by doing some operation, multiplying it by some matrix. We can always turn it out into a matrix form. For instance, let me just do this again. So if we say U, let me just think of this equation for simplicity. And this is un plus 1 minus un divided by delta t. This is u at the point j plus 1 minus u j minus 1 divided by 2 delta x. And n, from here, I'd say un plus 1 at the point j is a matrix that will involve un at j, un at j plus 1, un at j minus 1. And we can write out what the matrix is just by looking at how these things are combined. We can look at this in explicit form, but at the moment, I just wanted to keep it general. So if you understand, if you're able to understand in this way, you can see that the solution un plus 1 is obtained by the solution of un by g. And you can keep going, right? So if I obtain, I can apply this to un, and so I have un is g, un minus 1, and so on. So ultimately, what you say is un plus 1 is g to the n plus 1 of u0. This has to do with, so if you do that, then the only thing you care about at the end of the day, so let me just give you the punchline, is what are the eigenvalues of this matrix, right? Because again, you could show that there is a transformation that will take you into some characteristic variables with respect to the discretization. And if those eigenvalues are below 1, when you take g to the n, that number is not blowing up, right? So in one case, it will blow. If otherwise, we will have mu to the n here after we apply it n times. And if mu is less or equal to 1, then so successive applications will not take you away from the initial solution. You all see that? So I don't want to go into details because it's going to go forever, but that's kind of the basic scheme. So let me just now say something that we can discuss it in different ways, but this is one way connected to this one. Suppose you have this equation again. and this is real. So obviously, if we write this matrix and we find the eigenvalue, this lambda will creep in, will be there. And if this lambda is 100, well, it's going to be difficult to get an eigenvalue below 1. Unless we choose this delta t. Remember, we've always been doing that delta t is equal to lambda delta x. One reason is because of this, of what I'm going to say now. Or not, let me just not say lambda, let me call it alpha. Oh, alpha is now loves. Any number? Gamma? No, that's also taken. Mu. Let's say just mu. So this, now let me just kind of speak in kind of dimensional terms. This has like u divided by delta t. I have a lambda u divided by delta x, right? Just dimensionality wise. So my g will have delta t divided by delta x times an operator, right? So the g will have lambda, but also will have delta t divided by delta x. So yeah, it's just 5 minutes and we're done. And this is the reason why if lambda is huge, we will be forced to take a delta t that is sufficiently small so that the multiplication of lambda delta t delta x is below 1 and we'll be always able to satisfy a condition like that. So that's the reason why we want this coefficient there, so that we can, if the code blows up, if you see the code just generate a solution that is going to hell, well, you can now say, okay, let me try to iterate to the same time, reduce this by a number of, by a factor of 10, say, which will make the code now 100 or 10 times more expensive. But let me just bite the bullet. And then you might see that all of a sudden something that was unstable all of a sudden became stable. And it's because you were just violating that thing. So it is very useful to know, this also has to do with our characteristics, knowing the eigenvalues, we know what to expect. If the eigenvalues are bounded by 1, we're in perfect shape. If they are larger than 1, well, we want to choose the lambda, or this mu, sorry. I forgot the mu. So that this, well, with lambda mu, so that this combination stays bounded by 1. And there is another criteria that is actually, it's a theorem you can actually prove. And this has to do with the domain of dependence. Have you guys heard that term, domain of dependence? No? Maybe not? This has to do with the following. Suppose you have a point where you want your solution, and you say, what portion, so this is some given time, and you just say, well, I have some other previous given time. And you ask the question, what portion of the previous time, the data that contains in the previous time, can determine the solution at that point? If you have characteristics, if you have a hyperbolic system that has maximum speeds, this is always a small kind of cone. Something here cannot affect something there, just because it will have to be propagated much faster than the equations allow. So that's, again, we want to know the eigenvalues, the characteristics, to know how wide this cone is. The theorem says, if you understand your analytical domain of dependence, the domain of dependence of the partial differential equations, and you're implementing the numerics such that you're not using enough points, or the points you involve in obtaining the solution there is smaller than the analytical domain of dependence, that means, suppose to update that point, I use these 3 points. So my numerical domain of dependence is this one. So the theorem says, if the numerical domain of dependence, that is the region of points that you're involving in your discretization to update the solution at a point of interest, is smaller than the true analytical domain of dependence, it's going to be bad. It's not going to be stable. That's because there is information that could exist here that you're not accounting for. And that will make errors just compound and then blow up. Which is another reason why we take this mu as something useful to have. Because this, the analytical domain of dependence will always be this cone. But if I'm choosing how far these times are from each other, so I can always fix that problem by saying, okay, let me not go to that hypersurface, let me go to this one. And I'm obtaining first a solution at that point, say. Okay, so now the analytical domain of dependence of this guy is that scheme. the number of points I'm using in the previous level, it's always the same. But now my numerical domain of dependence is this one, and it's containing the analytical domain of dependence. You always want to contain the analytical domain of dependence. You want to have a scheme that is wider than what the analytical analysis will tell you. And again, this is very much related to the argument we just gave, that you want the eigenvalues of your matrix to be bounded by one. Because again, this is by choosing a smaller mu, you reduce the distance in between the two slices, and also you reduce the effective final eigenvalue of your matrix. So these are two criteria that you better be careful with. Different schemes will have different criteria. So typically, let me just go back to this one. Different schemes can cope with eigenvalues that are larger than one. There are some schemes that will do that. But they are always bounded. There is always a number. It's 2, 3, whatever. So what you will discuss the very last day of class is that, well, depending on the scheme, you have to be mindful of what's the maximum value that that scheme allows you. And from there, you know how much freedom you have to play around. But you're always going to have to bound how distant two neighboring hypersurfaces will have to be to get a stable scheme. So let me just stop here, because then we're going to go too far. As I said, next week we're going to start something completely different. It's going to be hydrodynamics. Do work on your problems. You can ask help from Dennis and Scott about this. I'll be in contact by email. If you need anything, you can let me know. And then the last week, we're going to get serious trying to make contact with kind of current research. But as far as your homework is concerned, we're going to keep it real and basic basic at the level you guys can do. So go over the notes, see if you have any questions, and then ask anything you need. Thanks.